Hi, everyone. Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. I'm your host, Greg Kubin.
And I'm your co-host, Matthias Serebrinski.
Matthias and I are partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and mental health. In today's episode, we welcome back Josh Hardman. A lot has happened in the past year in psychedelics, so it can be hard to make sense of where we're at and where we're heading. While no one quite knows the answers, Josh Hardman has some clues. Josh is a leading writer in the psychedelic industry and the founder and editor of Psychedelic Alpha, an online resource and newsletter covering the intersection of psychedelics and business. If Josh's name sounds familiar, it's because he was previously a guest in an episode released in June of 2021. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, you can find it on your Business Trip podcast feed titled Analyzing the Atai Life Sciences IPO. Josh regularly writes and collaborates with experts, including entrepreneurs, investors, academic researchers, and nonprofits, to offer resources and data sets to help individuals and organizations understand this growing field. Psychedelic Alpha recently released a 2022 Psychedelics Year in Review to comment on and analyze the psychedelic industry across research, funding, and policy. This episode covers several topics, including the growth of the psychedelic market from 2022 into 2023. We discuss the paths to commercialization for organizations like MAPS and Compass Pathways, the impact of state legalization, and we ask Josh about his outlook for fundraising and job opportunities in the field. With that, we hope you enjoy this conversation. Let's get right to it. Josh, welcome to Business Trip, our first recorded episode of 2023. And partially why we wanted to bring you onto the podcast was to help us better understand really what has happened within the psychedelic space over the last year, and also looking into the crystal ball of where you think we're heading. It would be great to first give a bit of context around Psychedelic Alpha, when you started it, how big it's become, and your origin story.
Thanks, Greg. So last time I came on the podcast was mid-2021. So not just in 2022, but in 2021, even a lot had began changing. But I started Psychedelic Alpha in early 2020, so before there was even a single listed psychedelics company, although some of the research and even the commercial research had been going on for a few years at that point. We were far before this kind of current renaissance of companies and commercial interests. But I guess my history of psychedelics started when I migrated from the countryside in England to London and then ultimately to Berkeley in California. Unsurprisingly, I came across psychedelics while studying the social history of the Bay Area. I was hanging out with hippies and Black Panthers and doing oral histories and staying with these folks and transcribing their histories and trying to understand where these countercultural movements came from, whether psychedelics played a kind of assistive role or whether they actually curtailed some of the efforts to bring people together on political grounds by encouraging people to look inward. So I came from studying these groups in the counterculture and then ironically to being in a position today where I'm looking at mainly the corporate side of things, which some people believe can work together and take learnings from the counterculture and have this reciprocity, whereas others think it's kind of diametrically opposite. So interesting how I've had this arc from one side to the other. And now I guess I'm trying with Psychedelic Alpha to bring that together. So bringing together the history of psychedelics with the current renaissance. And basically what we do is we try and put things out that are useful. So there's other publications in the space that maybe do a better job of journalism, Lucid News. There's others that do a better job of looking at the research. My friends at Blossom. But we really focus on trying to look at thematic things. So at the moment, things non-hallucinogenic psychedelics, things policy reform. So these big themes that have emerged over the past few years and have become quite salient. We haven't pursued growth in terms of subscribers. We have just over 10,000 subscribers today, which is almost exactly the same as what we had at the start of last year. So we regularly clean our mailing list and only retain people who still want to be subscribed. At the start of our website, we had lots of retail investors who had seen MindMed and Numinous go public. And over time, they've dropped off as we've began focusing more on research policy and kind of the future. So yeah, we've embraced our niche. And instead of looking to aggressively grow in terms of the numbers of subscribers and readers, we've tried to grow in terms of respect and authority, with the existing people in the field that we think matter, entrepreneurs, researchers, practitioners, and patients. So that's really been the arc of Psychedelic Alpha. Started off covering pretty much just public companies, and now almost the opposite, trying to think more holistically and more thoughtfully about the future of the space.
How do you pick the themes that you'll focus on? You mentioned legislation, policy reform, non-hallucinogenic psychedelics. How do those things get into your zeitgeist, and why do you end up going with some and not other ones?
It's a great question. And similar to the psychedelic experience, we don't really know why certain things come up and why certain things feel salient in the moment. But really, I have this kind of fire hose of information. I have this web scraper that scrapes everything that mentions psychedelics. And over the last 3 years, I've trained it by saying, no, I don't want to see 100 listing prices of psychedelic anonymous NFTs every day. And I don't want to see this link to how to microdose every day. And over time, it gives us popular media articles, policy reform bills, company news. And just through seeing that and seeing this news on a constant basis, you start thinking of themes, and maybe the themes aren't being discussed. For example, with policy reform, and with patents, actually, is probably a better example. There was plenty of public company press releases, and actually private companies as well, press releasing that they had filed on patents. But there wasn't really anyone trying to make sense of what that actually meant, all of these patents getting approved, and also what that might mean ethically and also commercially for the companies involved. So that's when I reached out to Graham, maybe 2-3 years ago, Graham Pechenik, who became my oracle in terms of psychedelic patents. And for the space, he's become a bit of an oracle in helping us understand patents and the issues and also benefits of psychedelic patents. So these themes came up organically of just looking at all of the news and all of the kind of data in the space and thinking, where's the knowledge gap here, or where could we benefit from some perspective? And in today, for our year in review, at the moment, at the time of recording, we've only published the more financial stuff. But the next section is a lot of research themes. So to come up with the research themes, we asked groups of researchers, which topics do you think are the most salient and important? And also we just looked at publications and looked at which topics are becoming more salient in the literature.
You've been in this space for a couple years now, and you've really watched a lot of the evolution from a lot of these small startups to larger entities and organizations. And there's really two salient ones that come to mind, being MAPS and Compass Pathways. Would love to hear your thoughts about how you're thinking about their paths to commercialization.
It's especially interesting. We just did some analysis of how long the phase two trials took, and MAPS took around 15 years and Compass's took a matter of a few years, which shows the benefits of private funding in terms of pace and scale. But also we just published a piece of Rick Doblin directed at MAPS itself as opposed to the public, where he was urging for a maintenance of this balance between public benefit and private profit. So there's a lot to be said about the different models, and this model of nonprofit drug development was incredibly disruptive and is super exciting. But now as we move towards commercialization and as the space has developed so much as an investable space, MAPS BBC is presumably going to struggle to raise the last bit of funding in order to commercialize. So this is an interesting time where we see how much does MAPS's MDMA therapy and Compass's psilocybin therapy come to resemble a more classic kind of pharmaceutical therapy as opposed to something that's incredibly disruptive. I also think it's going to be super interesting to see how payers assess these therapies, because obviously they're to cost at least early five figures, but $20,000, $30,000 for a course of therapy. Last year, there was a huge focus on approval. Who will be the first to be approved? Will it be approved? Whereas now, this year, the focus is really going to shift to from approvals to access. So how are these drugs and therapies going to be accessible? Who will cover them? And for what indications? How restrictive will the REMS be on them? What will off-label prescribing look? So I think this is going to be the big shift in discourse as we move closer to potential approvals. But yeah, I also think you could do a whole podcast on this topic, because there's many interesting things around how MAPS's therapeutic protocol, if you look at the manual, it gives therapists an incredible amount of latitude. They can practice more directive therapies, they can use somatic therapies, breath work, whereas Compass's psychological support, which they're quite strict at calling it psychological support, not therapy, is much more safety-oriented. It's not so much about urging the patient to break through, it's more about preparing them for that session and then being very non-directive. And some of that is to do with the different phenomenology of the drug. MDMA obviously is more outward, whereas psilocybin is more introspective. But I also think there's just something commercial there. It's in Compass Pathways' interest to try and demonstrate that a majority of the efficacy is down to the drug, not necessarily the skill of the therapist involved. So we're also seeing these themes become emergent in terms of what's more important to traditional commercial-minded drug developer versus a group MAPS, which obviously had more kind of psychedelic roots, more of a roots in kind of the therapists themselves. So we're going to see plenty of interesting themes that come to the fore this year.
Would you mind explaining the difference between the two MAPS?
Okay, yeah. So MAPS.org, which is now how they refer to it, the nonprofit, which was founded over 20 years ago, they have a wholly owned subsidiary, which is MAPS Public Fit Corp. And MAPS.org is now the kind of drug policy reform side and harm reduction side, which houses all of the efforts on that front, whereas MAPS PBC and also MAPS Europe. But MAPS PBC is tasked with commercialization and bringing MDMA-assisted therapy to market. If they continue to raise money on the basis that they have in the past, MAPS PBC would hope to recycle many, if not all, of the revenues back into MAPS.org in pursuit of continuing education around drugs, harm reduction, and maybe like special access programs for people in different countries and regions where it's not feasible on a cost basis. But yeah, that's going to be interesting. To what extent will that be viable for MAPS PBC to be recycling the revenue into the nonprofit? These kind of plans are all coming under closer scrutiny now as they move towards submitting an NDA to FDA.
So you talked about the topics of accessibility, commercialization as the burning issues right now, and we'll get answers in the next few months and years. But I'm curious about your predictions or analysis of what is mostly to happen.
Something I've become increasingly interested in is health economics. I have an economic background myself, but I used to be doing cost-benefit analyses of a cycle lane and where is the most impactful place to put a cycle lane in, like a small regional town in England. So it's not directly translatable. But the group at UC Berkeley are doing really interesting work in looking at the cost effectiveness of psychedelic therapies. And some people are like, oh, it's wrong to try and reduce the psychedelic experience to a cost benefit analysis. But ultimately, that's what payers want to see. So that is going to be the most crucial element for payers. Is this effective? Obviously, is it safe? But is it cost effective? What's going to be interesting and what will play out soon is when we have a look at the data from MAPS's second phase three, we'll begin to see whether MDMA therapy is similarly effective in a more mild PTSD population. Because the first phase three that MAPS did, for example, was with severe treatment-resistant PTSD, whereas the second one is a milder population. So that will be very interesting. And then obviously, as these drugs move into the real world, it will be interesting to collect that more longitudinal, long-term data on cost efficacy, because that's what will be required to get insurers on board. And we've seen the issues with this in England and the UK with Spravato, Janssen's product. They've refused to cover it in the UK many times because there's not enough long-term evidence of cost effectiveness. So that's an interesting case to look into more, and we've written about it quite a bit. But I think the same thing's going to play out here. We have to be able to show that these are cost effective in the medical model. So that's going to be one of the big things to watch. And then that is inherently related to how restrictive the FDA is with what therapist to patient ratios they require. That will have a huge effect on the cost of the therapy, and also how MAPS PBC decides to price the MDMA, which is where they'll have their markup. They don't really intend to make any money on therapy or therapist training. They intend to make their money on marking up the MDMA. So we have to wait to see how these things play out. But I would imagine in the first instance, we'll see the most severe PTSD patients being eligible for this on their insurance plans, and perhaps something the VA coming through and running pilot studies or just making it available to people in the VA network would make sense to me. I can see that happening.
It's so nuanced, because on one side, you said that the UK Spravato wasn't approved as a reimbursable therapeutic. At the same time, the UK is funding ketamine research around alcohol use disorder through a company called Awaken. And how all these things will ultimately play out and which companies will be the ones that have an important participation in the market, even with the same or a very similar drug, it's still unknown.
Yeah, I think with the Awaken stuff, it's important to remember that the aggregate amount of funding is still very small, right? It's part of NHS innovation. And also the UK government invested in Beckley SciTech, and they gave seed funding to small pharma through various state-backed funding schemes. So there is an interest, at least in the UK, to support psychedelic drug development. But I think when the rubber hits the road and the NHS has to pay for it, when you have these big single-payer systems, that's when you really have to show evidence. And the NHS NICE, which is the healthcare technology, the Health Technology Assessment Agency in the UK, they have a doctrine that the higher the resource burden, so the more expensive or difficult a technology, a therapeutic is to implement, the higher the cost effectiveness certainty must be. So when it comes to that, it doesn't matter how receptive the government is when they're going to have to pay to do this. That's when things get real. And especially if you imagine all of a sudden you have this huge addressable market of patients who have PTSD, and all of a sudden they're eligible for access to this. The NHS has to try and be equitable, so it'd be a huge initial outlay. So that's the other thing, thinking about how will this slowly ramp up in terms of therapist availability and demand. Maybe insurers and stuff will use kind of patient subsets or the very restrictive sets of patients first and slowly roll out bigger and bigger.
Have you analyzed or looked at the historical precedent of the UK versus the United States in terms of coverage, where the UK is more single payer, the United States is the private insurer model?
There's interesting things in terms of when you have private insurers. My uncle, he came out of school and got a job and worked his way up in a company and stayed there for pretty much his whole life. Whereas now, obviously, people move between jobs. So insurers, especially in the US, are now thinking of things on the shorter term timescale, right? 3-4 years, which is concerning for things like this, which have a long payoff period, versus something like the NHS in the UK, which theoretically at least should be well positioned to make longer term decisions like this that have healthy behaviors in the long term or better health outcomes in the long term. And not only on an individual level, but also on a population level. So with diseases like PTSD, when you try and monetize the benefits of something like MDMA therapy, a lot of the benefits are externalized benefits. So the reduction of externalities, so increasing productivity, not just reducing healthcare costs, basically. So systems that are better positioned or better incentivized to account for those things, so like productivity and social costs of disease, are a better place to cover psychedelic therapies. But as I say, in reality, something like the NHS should be having a longer time horizon. But at the moment, many healthcare systems is in absolute crisis, right? It's chronically underfunded, it's chronically understaffed, and there's a huge unmet resource burden in terms of physical space. So when you take that into account, and as was written in the Spravato assessment, it's going to be very difficult to find the space for psychedelic therapy. This will be one of the big kind of lobbying efforts, I'm sure, for drug developers to convince bodies like the NHS and insurers that it will pay off even in the short term.
So we talked about MAPS and Compass as the two first companies that will potentially bring psychedelics to market. What other companies are most exciting to you?
I get asked this question a lot and I always find a way of deflecting it. So maybe I could say something about like the operations of a company and then maybe something thematic. So in terms of when I look at companies at the moment, especially given the uncertain financial and fundraising environment, like me and the investors I speak to are looking at a lean operation, especially in drug discovery and development, that has a lot of the focus on research and development. Even up to last year, we saw some of these publicly traded drug development companies spending millions a year on investor relations and marketing. So now when I'm looking at companies, we're looking to see that there's a huge amount of proportional spending going to the actual underlying research. So that's a basic. I won't get excited about a company until I can see that, until I can see that the researchers are being listened to and funded. But then thematically, I already mentioned these non-hallucinogenic psychedelics or psychoplastogens are interesting for two reasons. One is obviously the promise that, you know, there might be ways of treating indications or patient populations that maybe don't want a trip or wouldn't benefit from a trip or are in a position where they might get benefit of taking these drugs daily. Not a microdose, but a psychoplastogen that helps with something through the underlying mechanism of neuroplasticity, for example. So I think that's interesting as a promise, but more than that, it's a way of scratching this itch, which is understanding whether the subjective effects are necessary, which is the question on everyone's mind from investors through to researchers and psychedelic advocates. It's quite a touchy subject, but I think it's super interesting. And there are precedent for these psychoplastogens, things like Ariadne, which is a DOM homologue, which was explored by Bristol Myers in the 70s. And they said that it had remarkable therapeutic promise for everything from schizophrenia through to Parkinson's. So today, people like psychedelics can treat anything. They were even doing that in the 70s at these kind of big pharma companies. But they dropped it because it had high 5-HT2B agonism, which is associated with valvular heart disease. So now we have this opportunity to kind of engineer new molecules that don't have these kind of off-target effects and could be immensely impactful. So that's one. And then if we go all the way to the other end of the value chain, so that was drug discovery, if we go through to like care delivery, there's some really interesting care delivery companies to get excited about. Whether they're profitable in the short term or sustainable business models or scalable is another question. But for example, Sunstone Therapies is doing really exciting protocol development. They're giving MDMA-assisted therapy not only to patients with cancer diagnoses, but also to their significant other who's dealing with adjustment. And adjustment issues are presumably about to deal with some immense grief of losing their significant other. And the sort of things that seem intuitive to anyone who's taken psychedelics, that seems like a great thing to do, but until now has been perceived to be precluded by protocol design and approval processes. So Sunstone Therapies and companies like that who are really pushing the envelope on these protocols are super exciting.
getting back to the non-hallucinogenic or psychoplastogen companies, there's something interesting to me around describing that class of companies as some of the most exciting to you. Similarly, are some of the most exciting to me. And the irony there is that those are the non-psychedelic companies. And there's something very interesting about working in the psychedelic space. But maybe that's also because of the commercializability of those types of companies, right? Like they may not require hours and hours of therapy and these models that may be difficult to actually commercialize and be accessible. So just spotting out the irony of something that I've experienced as well when I've described, like, what's your favorite psychedelic company? Let's talk about the non-psychedelic companies for a moment.
Yeah, I also think there are valid ethical concerns around them becoming the default, right? Yaden and Griffiths wrote a good piece about how if we know that psychedelics are among the most meaningful experiences of someone's life, up there with the birth of a first child or a marriage or meeting a loved one, if we know that, which we do based on survey evidence and studies, is it right to instead offer as the default these non-hallucinogenic psychedelics? So I think there are important considerations, and perhaps one way to overcome that is also being an advocate of decriminalization, so that if not in the medical model, people can have these experiences safely and legally, or at least decriminalized. So I would point that out. And just quickly, outside of the company point of view on the non-hallucinogenic thing, there's really cool researchers like Boris Heifetz at Stanford and the University of Wisconsin group who are trying to use more hacky methods to do trials to work out whether these non-hallucinogenic psychedelics work, quote-unquote, now. So Boris is giving people ketamine under anesthesia, and the UW-Madison group are giving people midazolam, which wipes out the memory of the trip to see if the memory of the subjective trip is important. So that's the other thing. We might not have to wait too long to see whether these work or whether it's just an enhanced placebo effect. So it's a super exciting area of research and perhaps one day commercialization.
Speaking of research, what themes around research are you following?
At the moment, these innovative trial designs, that's something I'm super interested in at the moment. So the ones I just mentioned. Also, moving back to more of a focus on the phenomenology of the psychedelic experience itself. In the last couple of years, we've become quite bogged down in trying to understand the more objective underlying processes like neuroplasticity. Whereas now there's some exciting research on even just the auditory hallucinations or visual disturbances and how that might relate to therapeutic effects. So I think that's kind of cool, like getting back to basics. And obviously there's companies trying to match the subjective states with the neuropharmacology, like Mind State Design Labs. So that's super cool as well. In terms of other themes, we have 10 research themes coming out as part of our year in review. So there's plenty more.
Josh, let's go back to talking about public companies and what happened last year. Let's start from the basics. Why public stocks tanked last year?
If you compare it to biotech indices and also the S&P 500, the broader market metric, for the first half of the year, at least, it was a correlated decline, right, with the broader market. It was still slightly deeper. But in the second half of the year, I mean, psychedelic stocks really outdid themselves and climbed new depths. So it was very painful. When I was last on the podcast, Atai was about to go public, and it was valued on the first day of trading just over $3 billion. And today, on the 1st of February, it's valued just south of $300 million. It's been across the board. Even the largest companies have hurt. The reason is, aside from these macro trends, is that there was a lot of hype and excitement. Many of these companies have inordinately large proportion of retail investors versus even a normal biotech comp company. So the majority of stocks that are freely traded are traded by retail investors in psychedelics. So at the first sign of a market correction, a lot of people fled the sector. We did some analysis as part of the year in review and looked at how much cash and cash equivalents these 50 or so public companies have. And at the end of the year, they had under $1 billion between them, so around $900 million. And when you think about that in comparison to how much it costs to bring a drug to market, which when you include failures is around $2 to $3 billion, a lot of investors had the harsh reality check that this is a long game. There's going to be a lot more fundraising needed. So that was another kind of wake-up call that there's going to be a huge amount more dilution and fundraising on difficult terms, given the environment. We did some analysis as well using RA Capital's methodology, where we counted the companies that had less than 2 years of cash runway and over a 25% burn to market cap ratio. And almost all public psychedelic companies fell within that remit. And even when we made it more lenient, so we said companies only needed a year of runway, still the majority were there. So it's only going to hurt more this year as a lot of these companies all of a sudden come to the market to try and fundraise again. So it was just overexuberance, and now the reality is creeping in. And also some investors, at least ones that I speak to, like stepping back now and thinking, should we not see what happens with maps? Should we not see what happens in Oregon? And should we not see how Compass Pathways gets on with their phase three program? So I think there's almost a kind of drawing back among some investors I speak to. On the other hand, our investor sentiment survey seemed to suggest that a lot of psychedelic investors, particularly larger investors, are still feeling quite confident in the long-term prospects of the space. So it's not all doom and gloom, but it's been a reality check.
I really appreciated and liked the analysis you did on runway for all these public companies. Outside of a couple exceptions, most companies are still alive. Do you still think that we'll see a massive death of companies in the next few months?
Most of them are alive in the sense that they're doing small public offerings or loan agreements or kind of these death spiral financings where you just have to keep printing shares, right, to issue. We've seen a couple of companies do that. De facto, there's over a dozen that are dead but haven't really put out the press release to say that they've ceased trading. And I just think I was reading something earlier today that someone sent me that was saying that the vast majority of biotech companies in general that raised in 2021 and 2020 are now going to have to come to market and raise again because you only raise a couple of years of cash runway. So I just think there's going to be a huge oversaturation of companies looking for funding. And really, a lot of the companies, especially the public ones, didn't actually come true on their goals, right, of trials. Their trial designs failed to get off the ground or they ran out of funding. So it's a nice opportunity for some M&A if there's single asset companies that actually have some progress. But I don't think it will be on good terms for the acquiree.
And wondering if you have a thought around what will it take for institutional investors to get more involved in the space?
Good question. Traditionally, institutional investors wait, and especially the big pharma kind of investors like Otsuka's kind of early stage arm who invested in Mindset via a collaboration, they usually wait for some validation, right? So like phase two. But yeah, I would be interested to know the sort of talks that groups like Compass Pathways are having behind closed doors. These institutional investors, their Overton window, right, is a bit narrower than us, whether it's because of psychedelics or whether it's because we're just in this emergent field. These institutional investors are more keen to back something like a non-hallucinogenic psychedelic or something short-acting like 5-MeO-DMT. I think the reason that was so appealing, GH research, was because of the short duration, which is way easier to fit within the existing healthcare system. And also, the interesting thing with GH research is that RA Capital, who was the lead investor, has now incubated their own 5-MeO-DMT company, Lucyrus Therapeutics, which will use a single sublingual dose as opposed to GH Research, which uses the volcano vaporizer and it uses a variable dose regime. So again, they've spun up their own 5-MeO company in-house, which is even more simplified. So it's not only a short-acting drug, it's also a sublingual tablet, which is at one dose, which is way easier than faffing around with this vaporizer. So again, it suggests that these large investors are looking of how can we integrate this more easily and commercialize it more easily in the prevailing system.
I would add to that team. Arguably, the teams that are, to your point, more traditional, have a pharma background, are more palatable for institutional investors are the ones that are getting funding. And this is obviously a generalization, but if I think of the recipe of companies that successfully are able to raise money, it's probably a team that are pharma veterans plus data, both from a clinical perspective and also from payers and other kind of participants in the ecosystem validating it, right? And so that is the recipe for more institutional investors to get involved in the field.
My unanswered question is, what percentage of those institutional investors has smoked DMT?
Interesting. So funnily enough, in our recent investor survey, we had some portion of quasi-institutional investors, so large multiple family offices, and larger VCs, the kind of Google Venture type VCs. And we ask investors in the survey on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being never and 5 being regular, how often have you used psychedelics or how would you characterize your psychedelic usage? And interestingly, all categories of investor went down, which suggests we have more investors in our community that haven't tried psychedelics, except for the larger quasi-institutional psychedelics investors. So that either means that the same investors, which a lot of them were, and they've had such a bad ride in the last year that they've had to go on an ayahuasca retreat to integrate their investment experience, or it means that the average investor, even institutional investors, are taking more psychedelics. I don't know.
Nice. Maybe in your follow-up survey, you do a more granular look of asking which compounds you've tried.
Yeah.
You touch on it a bit, but looking ahead, when will we rally? Do you think it is really contingent on MAPS and Compass's next readouts as key inflection points? Is it with Oregon and the rollout there and showing what adoption looks like on the state level? What do you think are potential catalysts for a rally?
Sure. There are some readouts coming down the pike from other companies, but I think I'm of the opinion that a lot of people are kind of waiting to see how restrictive the FDA is with MDMA and also how it's responded to by payers, which obviously is a big consideration, and that affects how you're able to price the therapies, which is obviously important for the revenue potential of the company. So I think, yeah, waiting for MAPS. And also, I don't think the average investor is waiting for Oregon. It's more the fact that if there are some kind of significant kind of hit pieces or genuine issues with the rollout in Oregon, then that could have an overall chilling effect. But really, you know, a cynic might say that might be beneficial, right, for the medical model, like the biotechs and biopharmas, because that allows them to position themselves as the safe option, which is exactly what we saw in the early days of these psychedelic companies, right? I remember J.R. Rahn from MindMed, the original CEO, going on podcasts and videos saying that he was against legalization and decriminalization because implicitly saying only our LSD is safe, right? The stuff you go on the street and the way that you take on the street isn't. So a cynic could say that any kind of real-world issues could actually better position these biopharma companies. But also, if people were waiting for Oregon, that's concerning because I spoke to Oregon Health Authority yesterday and they haven't given out a single license. Yeah, and they've had no license applications for facilitators because they aren't trained yet. Only 3 service centers have applied and 1 lab has applied. So if people were hoping that Oregon was going to be this huge kind of real-world data opportunity, I think it's going to take some time. And obviously, there's been debates around data collection in general. So, but I don't think the more sophisticated investor that's going to provide the follow-on funding that these late-stage companies need is too concerned about what's going on in these kind of decriminalized settings. I think they're more concerned with how the market and the existing healthcare system is going to integrate psychedelic therapies. So we don't know how prescribers and practitioners themselves are going to react to psychedelic therapy. How long will it take to get them on board and get them to a position where they're willing to recommend this to their patients? So, and rallying will be dependent not only on macro conditions, but seeing how things like MDMA therapy fare in the nearer term.
Interesting, your point that Oregon and other kind of like state legislation initiatives may actually have more of a downside risk than an upside opportunity when it comes to investments and FDA-approved therapeutics. I really want to do an episode all focused only on Oregon and what's happening there, but just for the sake of bringing people up to speed, can you explain a little bit more what a lab means, what a center means, what a facilitator means? What are all these different players that will be interacting with psilocybin in one way or another in Oregon?
Yeah, for sure. So Oregon has the Oregon Psilocybin Services, which is explicitly non-medical. So you're not allowed to provide any kind of service that could be construed as medical or therapy. But the state will regulate the provision of psilocybin services, which led by facilitators. So people who have gone through a kind of state-approved certification program and becoming a psilocybin facilitator. And then these sessions, so these kind of psilocybin experiences happen at service centers, which have to be licensed. The mushrooms, which can just be Psilocybe cubensis, so one type of naturally produced mushroom, have to be produced by licensed manufacturers, and they have to be tested in licensed laboratories. And then there's a whole system around the supply chain to make sure that there's no kind of diversion. So it's quite heavily regulated. And all of this regulation, including issues around federal illegality, leads to high costs. So service centers, for example, can't recoup the cost of goods sold because the IRS doesn't allow you to claim a tax write-off on producing what they deem to be illegal drugs. So there's all these issues. The licenses are expensive. The license for a service center is $20,000 a year, which is many multiples of a license for a dentist or a psychiatrist that they would be paying to their board. So a combination of all of these issues with federal illegality, getting banked, getting insured, taxes, and then also these license fees and the laboriousness of going through zoning and all these other regulations is the reason why we're seeing such a slow rate of applications. It's going to be interesting to see if this picks up. And Oregon's psilocybin advisory is a fee-based model. So they only generate revenue through these license fees. So they're also having to go back to the Oregon state government cap in hand and ask for some kind of bridge funding because there's not enough licenses to cover the operation at the moment. It's going to be interesting. And I think just quickly, another consideration when we think about how these two market, so to speak, this kind of adult use decrim legalized market, and then the kind of medical FDA approved market, how they might infringe on each other or encroach on each other. It's also worth thinking about, these are expensive, and people always say the issue with decrim and adult use is that people are paying out of pocket, and only a certain subset of people can afford to spend $3,000 or $4,000 to go to a retreat in Jamaica, or $1,000 to go to a service center in Oregon now. But I was actually thinking earlier today, in America, you have a copay system, right, where you pay anywhere around 20% of the cost of your therapy. So if you imagine MDMA therapy costing $20,000 to $30,000, and you have to pay your copay on that, could be $5,000 to $6,000 out of pocket. So as we start thinking about how these two markets might emerge, we have to think of the trade-offs that people are going to be making when they think about whether to go to a kind of adult use market or through the medical model. So all of these things are considerations that are emerging when people are thinking about this. And then obviously the elephant in the room is decrim, right? Why would you pay anyone when you might just be able to go and buy it off the street and take it yourself? So these are interesting ethical issues and kind of safeguarding issues when we think about people with serious mental illnesses. So yeah, many things to think about.
So one other topic I wanted to talk through is the job market within psychedelics. Psychedelic Alpha has a job board, which I will often route people to. And at the same time, you're analyzing data, speaking to lots of companies. Where do you see the job opportunities that are available today? And how do you see that evolving over the next couple of years?
Over the next couple of years, there's going to clearly be a focus towards commercialization, right? Amongst, if you just look at MAPS, PBC, and think about how many roles they're going to need to fill to commercialize. So medical liaisons, scientific liaisons, people focused on access and market access. So that's going to be a clear area amongst the kind of later stage drug developers. But I think amongst the startups and the more early stage companies, it's a good market for consultants at the moment, because these companies are quite cash strapped. And a lot of them, especially in discovery and development, are looking to avoid expensive mistakes. So they kind of want someone who's maybe experienced in preclinical development and understands how to interact with a CRO, how to avoid costly mistakes and how to evaluate quotes. So we've seen quite a few people in our talent pool on the job board get placed into kind of advisory roles like that and consultancy roles. Maybe there's going to be some roles in business development. I think we're seeing quite a lot of those posted on the job board at the moment. But I think the other one that's interesting is, I know a couple of the larger psychedelics companies are looking for a really specific type of person who's someone who has some experience in the digital therapeutics, software as a medical device space, and then also experience in pure drug development and drug discovery and clinical development of a drug, in order to inform their development of these kind of predictive technologies to predict who's going to respond to psychedelics, but also these kind of digital therapeutics to help with prep and integration, and then also the long-time kind of digital phenotyping of patients to decide if and when a patient should have another dose of psychedelic therapy. So I know there's at least two big psychedelics companies looking for someone who has that perfect blend of the digital therapeutics and the drug development experience, because these combination therapeutics, it's a whole different FDA pathway, and any kind of digital device entails a different kind of approval process or commercialization process. So I know that those type of people are in big demand. But yeah, as you said, thanks for the shout out, the job board, jobs.psychedelicalpha.com. If you sign up, if you fill out your complete profile, you'll be added to the talent pool, which basically allows us to go in. And we hear about a lot of roles, especially more senior roles, off the board. Obviously, they don't get posted on the board. So if you sign up and fill out your profile, we go in there from time to time and look for people who might be relevant for a specific role that we've heard about. So I would just urge people who are interested to do that, and or just email me, josh@psychedelicalpha.com.
We recently brought someone on board to the business trip team and the assignment team, and we used the job board, and I can say that we got fantastic candidates. So amazing resource.
Amazing.
I guess one other question on the job side of things, and maybe it's because I've worked in startups and tech for almost 10 years before this, definitely getting a lot of interest from people who had been working at startups in Silicon Valley and wanting to get more involved in this space. So they're not really coming from the scientific or drug development background. Do you have any thoughts about the kinds of positions that are available for those folks today?
It's a good question. And there's this kind of perennial debate in biotech in particular about prioritizing operators. I mean, obviously you would ideally have a perfect blend of operators and doers and builders and scientists and researchers, right? But there's this debate around whether it's more important to have the scientific team and coddle them and protect them at all costs, or whether to really focus on the future market and commercialization and building and doing. But yeah, I think there is good scope for people from the startup world. There's probably more roles on the kind of people that have experience in biotech, especially given how the market is, right? A lot of people were laid off in biotech and biopharma in the past year. So there's a lot of latent talent. So it would just be a harder sell for them to convince, especially in discovery and development companies, it would be a harder sell for them to convince that they're the right candidate if they don't have experience in that field. Most of the companies are still small enough that they have a general application, or you can just email them and it's worth having a call with the company, even just to be on their radar, or emailing us and having a call with someone on our team and we can keep you in mind. But it is definitely a harder sell. But the thing to think about as well is these infrastructure companies. When you look at the $2 billion that was raised by psychedelic companies in 2021, or the $500 million that was raised in 2022, when you look at it on a chart based on where it went in terms of the value chain segment, the vast majority is drug discovery and development. But that's just because it's so capital intensive. When you look at other segments like technology, clinics, there is an increasing amount of investor interest, and there is enough to sustain a bevy of startups there. So also look beyond the big drug discovery and development companies and look at these startups. For example, Journey Clinical is hiring at the moment after their round, which I know you guys participate in. And companies like that who are solving the kind of infrastructure level of and looking ahead what's needed to actually make this scale, that can benefit from the startup experience and mentality.
I would add a couple of things to that. One is I get on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, connected with folks that want to break into the industry. And usually my kind of advice is start by putting something out there. Show the world what you can do. And that could look like writing or doing an analysis on a sector or doing a side project or collaborating with a company on a volunteer basis. So it's so important to move from just a resume and papers and words to something that someone has put out in the world. And that just usually works out. So that's one thing. Yeah. And then you mentioned this idea of there's so much money now in the biotech and drug development sectors, and that's capital intensive. I would argue it's also a function of where we are in the sense of psychedelics coming to the medical ecosystem or coming to the market. We're so early, and I just keep saying this and try to remember it for myself, that maybe today the largest opportunities are still in drug development, but that should change over time as this paradigm shift actually ends up happening.
I like that. And that's where the startup mentality can be useful, right? Like having a longer time horizon, thinking about the problems that need to be solved now and in the future. So maybe it's just positioning yourself for something in the future. But I like your point about doing something and creating something as well. And anyone out there who has an interesting take or an interesting piece of data analysis they want to do, or an interesting way of looking at psychedelics and the sector, if you don't have a venue to publish it and you don't want to start a Medium or a Substack, Psychedelic Alpha, we've done this in the past. We're happy to give you a platform. And obviously we can pay if it's something more involved, but if it's just something you want to get out there, then do reach out. But yeah, I agree, Matthias, just doing something and building. I just made this website in a cafe in my hometown in rural England when I was visiting my parents and was bored. I went and sat in a cafe and made a one-page website about psychedelic companies. And now I get to hang out with people like you. So it's definitely a good advert for just doing something and just putting something out there. So yeah, I encourage everyone to do that.
Awesome. Love it. So let's move on to the rapid fire questions. Ooh. So my first question is, how many hours a day do you read?
7 hours and 32 minutes on average. Probably about that. I mean, but I skim everything. And then I have millions of tabs open that I revisit before bed. And my girlfriend gets very annoyed because it's like 1 a.m. and I'll be in bed. And she'll say, turn it down, turn the brightness down, because I'll be reading some neuropharmacology that I do not understand and messaging my friends who are smarter than me, asking them what this receptor is or what a downstream effect is. So yeah, 7.5 hours a day probably.
That's impressive. Do you think that psychedelics will still be a hot topic in 10 years?
Yeah, but I think people will be working out how we can stratify patients, how we can decide which psychedelic therapy people should be doing, where they should be doing it. I hope that would be the point at which we're at in 10 years. We'd have multiple options.
Do you think the brain creates consciousness?
Rapid fire. No idea. I don't even want to speculate. I'm not smart enough. I don't have a lateral brain. I can't even imagine things when I close my eyes. I have aphantasia. So I can't even conjure an image when I close my eyes. So how do you expect me to answer that?
Do you do sponsored posts?
Not anymore. In our first year, we took money from a few public companies, but we very quickly realized that it was probably going to be better in the long run to build kind of credibility. And if we did today, we would just make it very clear that the company was supporting our ability to produce good journalism as opposed to having editorial influence. So no, we haven't done for a couple of years.
What role do you think reciprocity should play in the industry?
A big one, especially for companies that are using or exploring drugs that have been stewarded for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I also think that there's ways that this can be done in exciting ways. So my friend Chris Burns has this interesting IP NFT that has this friends protocol that has kind of reciprocity built into it. And also there's ways of encumbering patents, for example, so that they can only be licensed to other entities and assignees that share similar ethical principles, and reciprocity should be one of those. But yeah, that's like a whole podcast for someone far smarter. Someone like Eduardo Schoenberg or someone from Chacruna would be better placed to speak to that than a white guy like me.
What prediction you've been dead wrong about?
Oh, there's so many. I don't know where to start. Well, I think actually we were reviewing our predictions from last year's year in review. And I said that there would be loads of M&A last year. And that's kind of my perennial prediction. I think I made that prediction for the last 2 years. And it didn't really come true. I mean, there was some limited stuff, right? It had been acquired. Entheon's phase one. Beckley acquired Eleusis, which was quite big. But yeah, I think I thought the pace of that would be a lot quicker than it was. So I was wrong.
Just out of curiosity, do you have a rationale as to why it's been slower?
I don't know. Maybe the validation that the acquiries needed to see like didn't come through, or like I also think Compass's phase 2b results, also the amount of adverse events really like shook people, and like the average person who wasn't looking too closely at like baseline adverse events and suicidality in these patient populations, I think the average person was like shaken by that. So I think that changed a lot of investor perception and like worried some investors. But in terms of M&A, I don't know, maybe it's because the market got so bad that there wasn't enough companies that had cash that could have acquired more, suddenly started thinking maybe we should just put this aside and extend our runway. That's probably the biggest reason within the space, Compass and Atai. Atai shelved its own candidates, right? And so did MindMed. So they weren't, you know, it would be a difficult sell maybe to start buying others.
Agreed. That was my guess.
If there's anything that you want to share with our audience, any closing thoughts, this is a good time to do so.
I like what Matthias said about just getting involved, put stuff out there. Yeah, my privileged position of being able to spend nearly 8 hours a day of reading everything and just chatting to people and observing the space was born out of that curiosity, but making that curiosity public. I think a lot of people have great thoughts and great ideas, but they keep them to themselves. Just put something out there, get involved, and also reach out to me directly like Matthias. And I have a lot of people saying they want to get involved in the space, but at the moment it is a lot of people who come from tech startups and that kind of world. I would love to hear from more early career researchers, especially because I think early career researchers come into a field and they're like, why is everything being done like this? Like the basic assumptions are all wrong. And over time, given how academia works, you just lose that kind of radical spirit and you just have to do things in the way that they've always been done. So I'm really excited at the moment about hearing from early career researchers who might have cool, discrete projects that they want to work on, and maybe we can help them get funding, whether it's grant funding or whether it's investment. So yeah, reach out to me. I'm an open book.
Awesome. Josh, this was a great conversation. Learned a ton. I feel like maybe I don't need to open your newsletter this week because I just got the digest. But thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you on again. I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
This is Business Trip, a podcast about the business of psychedelics. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMed Ventures. And if you're building a company in psychedelics, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Hubin.
And I'm Matthias Serebrinski.
Our producer and editor is Jonathan Davis, with production coordination from Caitlin Nur. Sound design and engineering came from Zach Frank. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time. We'll see you next time. See you next time.